Start right out teaching. I've been reading. I want you to get to know D. Campbell Morgan. His messages were transcribed by a devoted follower. And he preached in such a way that you could transcribe it as he preached it. It was ready to print. I don't want the top of my head cut off. No, just cut the beard off. I'm not going to make it easy on these people that are shading. That's the point. They don't know how to handle my white hair. Get on back here, Ed. You're too far away. Whoa. They don't know how to handle white hair. Last night I had white hair and a light coat, and it drove them crazy. Tomorrow night I'm going to wear a red coat, I think. That's the one they really can't handle. Maybe time to have Secret 9 and buy some new cameras. When I came here 18 years ago, they said these cameras have a 7-year life, and they already have 4 years into them. So at the most, we'll get 3 years out of them. Not this Scotchman. 18 years. You better find a good repairman. I'd like to get two more years out of them. Like an old classic car. It's almost costing more to keep these running now than... Somewhere around here we got... with the Hartford station, we got somewhere around here being cannibalized. The original cameras that used to be in Yankee Stadium. They look like semi-trucks and trailers. Big, giant. I'm a little disgusted that we still don't have those operating. G. Campbell Morgan preached at Westminster Chapel, and the Westminster Pulpit is the series that came out of it. Any evangelical preacher worth his salt has Morgan on his library shelves. He's special to us because in his senior years, he preached under the Jesus Save signs that are over our cathedral. And I've been dealing with his series of messages that he entitled The Problems of the Religious Life. It takes a man of courage to preach any series of sermons entitled The Problems of the Religious Life. If I were to take that series on, that's why I'm just giving you his. If I were to preach my own series on the problems of the religious life, there ain't enough books to hold it all. So I'm limiting it to Morgan. I've preached or taught you parts or all of various messages that are part of this series. Now I'm going back to the first, the one that started the series when he did it. And he entitles it, The Problems of the Religious Life, Has Man Anything to Do with God? Now, in this one, it's interesting because he's going to share his own personal faith journey. And what was the first rock on which he could put his foot and start building his faith, having lost it temporarily? And what I find interesting is that rock he found footing on wouldn't have worked for me. So I'll be able to use his own testimony to show that the starting point doesn't have to be the same for everybody. But let's get into his message. To the ears of the Christian believer, the question, has man anything to do with God, anything at all, seems superfluous. And I think I may almost say it sounds grotesque. That fact notwithstanding, to vast numbers of men and women, it is the most perplexing of questions and constitutes the initial religious problem. Do we have anything to do with God? If that question could be settled, the whole attitude of their life would be altered. Sure would. Particularly those that get the urge to find something out there, or to find themselves, or to be themselves. And they leave God out of the equation. Has man anything to do with God? The question is full of interest at the present time. It exactly expresses the mental attitude of the scientist today. 30 years ago, now you've got to add a lot of years to that because he was preaching these messages more than 30 years ago, the scientist was not in the humor to ask questions. He was making affirmations, declaring quite reverently, quite devoutly, quite honestly, but with absolute dogmatism, that God, if there be one, is unknowable by man. But that's not the mood of the scientists of today. Today, the scientist is on the much saner and safer ground of asking, not necessarily in this language, but to this effect and in this spirit, has man anything to do with God? He may not yet write God with a capital G. Indeed, he may not use the word God at all, but he's recognizing that behind all material phenomena, there is something. And he is now inquiring honestly, reverently, with profound earnestness, what relation has man to this fact? The question is an interesting one for another reason. It indicates the point at which theology becomes religion, or fails to become religion. Theology is the science of God, the truth concerning God, the facts concerning God so far as they have been discovered and recognized. Theology is not religion. It's quite necessary to religion, but it is not religion. A man may be theological and irreligious. The point where theology merges into religion, or else declines to be religion, is where the question is asked, has man do anything with God? Well, okay, G. Campbell Morgan, he's clever. He is maybe the best at getting the attention of those that aren't going to be preached to. But I'm a semanticist, and theology comes from theos. And it's pretty hard to not be religious if you're going to study the science of theos. God. Theology is religious, but it may not be Christian. I'd like to correct G. Campbell as much as I love him on that one. The question is interesting in the third place, so we leave out the second one. I don't think he's right on that. Because it challenges the Bible. Now, that I agree with. Has man anything to do with God throws a challenge? The question throws a challenge to the Bible. Because the Bible is the drama of God doing a lot with man and man doing a lot with God. So in essence, you're challenging the whole biblical frame. I don't mean it attacks the word, attacks the Bible when I use the word challenge. The Bible assumes an affirmative answer to that inquiry. Right. The Bible never argues for the existence of God. It takes God for granted. Right. From its first stupendous and majestic word to its last glorious refrain, it is a book, the theme of which is the relation between man and God, defined, enforced. So that when I ask the question, has man anything to do with God, I challenge the Bible. I do not contradict it, but I inquire as to the accuracy of its presumption. This initial question, which is a serious question to hundreds of men today, is of interest because it exactly expresses the mental attitude of the scientist today, because it indicates the point at which theology becomes religion. I'd rather say theology becomes Christian, and because it challenges the Bible. Now, faith, and by faith I mean for the moment the attitude of mind of the Christian man, glad he said for the moment, because faith's more than that, recognizes the right to make such an inquiry, and I agree. It also insists that the right to inquire involves the responsibility to consider the evidence. I want to make that quite clear to anyone who is inquiring. You have a perfect right to inquire. Do not believe any preacher or any man who claims to be a prophet who tells you you have no right to ask questions. Good. You will never find bedrock for religious faith until you have learned how to ask questions. It is equally true that the right to ask questions involves the responsibility of considering the evidence. Right. A true agnostic should not only question faith, but also question doubt. I added that. You have no right to ask questions and then imagine that there is no answer. Right. In other words, don't just be a smartass. Morgan would never say that. You must listen to the answer. You are not bound to accept it, but you must listen to it. That is to say, the man who asks a question does by such action indicate the fact that his mind is open and that he desires an answer. If not, then the man who asks questions is a trickster. See, Morgan's trickster. Scott says smartass. We have no time for him. Right. No patience with him. Right. When Jesus stood confronting Pilate and Pilate asked him questions, Christ said to him, quote, sayest thou this of thyself, or did others tell it thee? Is your agnosticism firsthand or secondhand? Another way of saying smartass. Honest agnosticism is to be respected, but not faddism and smart alecky agnosticism. It is a very important question to begin with when you're going to ask a question. If the question you are asking in the presence of the Christian religion is a question you've heard in Hyde Park, the London equivalent of what Pershing Square used to be here in Los Angeles, where everybody gets it on a box and runs off at the mouth, and you repeat it glibly because you think it sounds clever, then in the name of God, I have no time or patience to deal with it. But if the question comes up out of the agony of your soul, as a sob out of your inner life, out of a tremendous, passionate desire to know the truth at all costs, Then, because the hand of my Lord has been upon me in ordination, my business is to try to help you. I may not have gotten very far, but as far as I've come, I want to show you the way. You remember Tennyson's In Memoriam? How he describes the fight of doubt for faith? I know it is an old story, but listen to it again. You say, but with no touch of scorn, sweethearted you, whose light blue eyes are tender over drowning flies, you tell me doubt is devil-born? I know not. One indeed I knew, in many a subtle question versed, who touched a jarring leer at first, but ever strove to make it true. Perplexed in faith, but pure in deeds, at last he beat his music out. There lives more faith and honest doubt, believe me, than in half the creeds. He fought his doubts and gathered strength. He would not make his judgment blind. He faced the specters of the mind and laid them. Thus he came at length to find a stronger faith his own, and power was with him in the night, which makes the darkness and the light, and dwells not in the light alone. From that I take the one line I endeavored to emphasize. He would not make his judgment blind, which means not merely that he would not accept a dogma simply because the preacher declared it to be true, but also that he would not accept his agnosticism as final until he had tested it by every power of his mind. He would not make his judgment blind. If you ask questions, you must be willing to weigh the answer. D. Campbell Morgan has long introductions. Suffer me still another word in the preliminary stage. Let those who are honestly inquiring recognize the difficulty of faith in the presence of their inquiry. By that I mean to say that there are those who are so certain, so irrevocably certain of God, that it is very difficult for them to argue for him or for man's relation to him. I remember my dear old father saying to me over and over again in days when I did not so perfectly apprehend his meaning as I've come to do since, in my own experience, I am far more sure of God than I am of myself. That's what his dad used to say. I'm far more sure of God than I am of myself. Now, if you are an inquirer full of questions, you can hardly understand that. I sure couldn't for many years. Even if you think it false, and there were very foolish who say that, please to remember that it is a conviction, that it is a sincere conviction, and remember that if the man of faith has to be patient with you, you must learn to be patient with the man of faith. All that is very preliminary. Yet I've taken time to say these things because they indicate, so far as I'm able to do, the attitude of my own mind toward the man who is inquiring in the spiritual realm. In attempting to deal with this question, I do so as giving evidence rather than as pleading a cause. 25 years ago, I came as a young man into a place of almost unutterable darkness about spiritual things. Two inquiries came to me with forceful power. First, is there a God after all? Second, if there be a God, have I any personal relations with him? Has he any personal, direct, immediate relationship to me. I'm bound again to pause a moment to say there are perhaps some of you here who have been Christians for years who never came to such a crisis as this. And I can tell you as I read it, I came to that crisis. 3.5 years of agnosticism. I can only say be patient with those who've been through it. Without undervaluing the quantity or quality of your faith, I still believe that what Tennyson says is true. The man who faces the specters of the mind comes to find a firmer faith his own, not firmer than yours. That's not what I'm saying. But firmer than the faith he had before he faced the specters of the mind. I want to say as I look back to that period of the eclipse of faith, and I think that's a correct description of what took place in my own mind, it was not caused by anything moral or immoral. I say that only in order to intensify the testimony I desire to bear to any who may be facing similar inquiries, and he names another, who preach first under the Jesus Save signs that are on the top of our cathedral, Dr. R. A. Torrey. I believe that Dr. Torrey affirmed that infidelity and immorality are always closely allied. That may be true in some senses, but I do not believe that all infidelity springs from immorality. I do believe, and this is a message in itself, I do not believe that all infidelity springs from immorality. As in his case, infidelity to God was not caused by an immoral act and an attempt to justify it. But then he reverses and says, I do believe, and this is the message that deserves to stand alone and be developed, but I'm going to keep going. I do believe that infidelity will work out into immorality. But that's another matter. So far from these inquiries arising out of any moral delinquency, they came immediately following the most definite experience of spiritual blessing that ever came over me. The eclipse swept over me in a day and hung over me for months, even for 2 years. I had been brought up in a home where my first slumbers were wooed by songs full of the music of the name of Jesus. The whole atmosphere of my home life was an atmosphere permeated by confidence in God. I never learned to doubt when I was a child. I had no chance. Then suddenly and apparently without cause, these inquiries came. Is it true that there is a God? And if it be true, has that God anything to do with me? It is the second of those questions which is the real theme of our talk together tonight. But the first is intimately related to it, and I choose to begin there after station break. Don't telephone. Is it true that there is a God? And if it be true, has that God anything to do with me? Back to basics. If your God's anything other than a convenient genie in a bottle to call on in trouble just in case, these questions are relevant. My answers, G. Campbell Morgan said, to these inquiries, in each case, are of the simplest. I propose to give the answers that came into my own experience and to tell you how they came. These answers do by no means reveal the final structure of faith. That is not yet completed. In his case, when he was preaching, and in any intelligent man's case until the moment. Remember, I've told you concerning my own faith, it's like a circle with many dots. In the center of the circle are a few solid dots. And then they get gray and more pale as I moved to the edge of the circle. Those solid dots in the middle took me out of agnosticism, and I've been working on the rest of the dots all the rest of my life, and will continue to do so. Ryle Niebuhr once talked about the circular relationship between faith and experience. That faith is like a set of glasses, that a myop, and we need faith the way a myopic man needs glasses. Some people can get along without them, but if you're myopic, you've got to have glasses, or everything's going to stay distorted. Now, depending upon your temperament, you may be able to just put your grandfather's glasses on. Or as the actor did in that movie Papillon, make a set out of the bottom of a Coke bottle. Or you may be like me. You got to go to the factory and see them ground. But at some point, you make a choice about the glasses you're going to try or wear, and you put them on. Now, if they're the wrong glasses, you're going to bump your shoulder and your elbow and your arm and stumble over every door jamb, and after you fall down and get bruised often enough, you'll decide maybe these glasses aren't right. That's the circular relationship between faith and experience. And you'll go back and regrind them or find another basis for choosing glasses. If they're the right glasses, even partially right, you'll bump fewer things, your movements will be truer, and your experience will confirm the rightness of the glasses. Leslie Weatherhead, I've referred to, another great British preacher, who preached a sermon on what he called the joys of agnosticism. Agnostics never take a stand. They're always questioning someone else's stand. That's why Morgan addressed, if you're going to ask the questions, you need to pay some attention to answers. You're not on target as long as you're agnostic. You're targeting everybody else's position. You ain't going to get anything done. You've got to somewhere decide, after all the agnostic queries, which set of philosophic glasses are you going to put on and start acting? And when you put them on, it won't be the final set of glasses. If they're the right glasses, they'll put you on a track. There are a great many things, back to Morgan, that I'm not yet sure about. Things about God, that's what I dislike about fundamentalists. They're sure about everything, including the inerrant word of God, King James, that was handed to Moses by the angels on Sinai. I hate people that have a monopoly of truth. They're dangerous. I'm sure about what I'm sure about, but I'm not sure about more things than I'm sure about. And I'm sure that I'm not sure for better reasons than the wooden-headed fundamentalists who are sure about what I'm not sure about. And if you're not sure what I said, that's okay too. I can't remember when I've done any teaching like this. There are a great many things I'm not yet sure about. Things about God, about man, about truth. The structure is in process of building. The final exposition, the ultimate explanation, I'm still waiting for. The first answers constitute the rock foundation upon which faith is being built. And the first stone of that structure of faith laid upon that rock foundation. 25 years ago, when the light came, I began again the life of faith, finding a firmer faith, my own. And I did so first upon the rock foundation of a simple conviction. And from that conviction came a first deduction. Which deduction was the first stone in the structure of faith which is not yet finished? And his experience may help some of you. It wouldn't have helped me. What then was that first piece of rock that I found underneath my feet in the day of faith's conflict, in the day of faith's eclipse 25 years ago? This. The consciousness of myself and the universe became the conviction of God. Say what? All I can say, bless his heart, and for all the blessings that he has been to me with his writings and his teachings once I came to faith, his starting point left me cold as a rock. And didn't do a thing for me. The consciousness of myself and the universe became the conviction of God. Not to this torn apart in his faith preacher's kid, but I'm going to give him a chance to explain it. After a process of inquiry and of attempt to restate the doctrines of the faith in such terms as would enable me to accept them, and finding myself utterly unequal to the task, there came a moment when, standing alone on the earth in the midst of the universe, I seemed to come to the consciousness of myself and of that universe. He had an epiphany. I almost hate epiphanatic people. I just made a word up. I don't doubt for a second that's what happened to G. Campbell Morgan. If I stood on this earth and was conscious of myself and the universe for 3.5 years, and it did no more for me in answering the question, is there a God, and has he, if he does exist, anything to do with me, than a fly buzzing by. He had an epiphany. That consciousness compelled me to affirm, it is infinitely easier in the presence of myself and the universe to believe that there is a God than to believe that there is not. To each his own, but not to me. I found it easier to believe he wasn't there in the presence of myself and the universe. I don't mean to be critical of G. Campbell Morgan. The fruit of that epiphany is his life of faith and the almost unequaled ability to expound the scripture. It's just those kinds of starting points, intuitive, personal, even give it the biblical meaning, deep calling unto deep, represent a non-transferable rock. Nobody else can stand on it. It's what we call ineffable. It's non-transferable. It's unknowable by another person except they have the same epiphany. Paul had one. He had one a lot more compelling than the one that G. Campbell Morgan had. Yet Paul already believed in God. He just had a caricatured view of him. God knocked him down, spoke with a voice out of heaven, blinded him, sent him to a man that told him his life story that he had never met before. That's a convincing encounter. I hated Paul, too, when I was doubting. He was so sure, as I read Paul's writings, he was so sure. I would be, too. God talked to me like that. But he never did. It is infinitely easier in the presence of myself and the universe to believe that there is a God than to believe that there is not. Okay? Good for you, G. Campbell. It was not much to stand on. Boy, that's the truth. But it was a bit of rock under the feet of a man who had been sinking. You say you demonstrated nothing. Right. That's exactly what I say. That is true. But I had a conviction. You cannot demonstrate a great many things of which you are absolutely sure. You are sure that the woman you call mother is your mother, but you cannot demonstrate it. Sorry, you can. He wasn't into the age of DNA and all the other modern scientific demonstration. Yes, you can. I did not get mathematical demonstration, but I got conviction and came at last to say, here am I. Here is the universe. I cannot believe that there is no God. There is a God. It was not much, just a bit of rock, but oh God, what a bit of rock means to a man who is drowning. I started there. If you can get a bit of rock under your feet, never mind the temple, just a bit of rock. Never mind the church, just a bit of rock. Never mind the theologians. Put your feet down and stand squarely on it. I totally agree. Then I accept his testimony. It doesn't do a thing for me. It doesn't give me any rock to stand on. As much as I like G. Campbell Morgan, that's not where Christianity places its feet. I've been telling you that for 18 years. I'll tell you again this Easter. Christianity places its feet on a historic fact rock. And it needs no epiphany. It just needs the guts to take the look, respond to the evidence, and when conviction comes in face of the evidence, act accordingly. I've been saying it ever since I came here. We've lost a generation by building Christianity on personal experience. Faith follows fact. Fact. Jesus Christ. As Paul said to the philosophers on Mars Hill, he is that unknown God to all you inquirers after the unknown. And God vindicated, ordained, set him apart, demonstrated. Who he was by the resurrection. You all know the dead I.O. Cannon Brian Greene. in his day, the equivalent of the Billy Graham of the Anglican Church worldwide. He came to Stanford University when I was plowing through the last phases of agnosticism. And he started me on the track of the uniqueness of Christ and the fact of the resurrection. I still remember when I sat in a third balcony and listened to him when he did not completely, but in part, because I've gone further with it, the uniqueness of Christ that produced the little booklet that I hope they run an ad for this session's over. The booklets I wrote, Jesus Christ, Supernut or Supernatural, in which he made the claim I've supported ad infinitum since, that there is no source that can be found for the historic Christ in which he is not making claims about himself so ridiculous he's either a madman or a fraud. Either a madman who believes the impossible about himself and could be adjudged good, but not wise, making impossible claims about himself that no man can make, or he's a fraud capable of convincing others things about himself that he himself knows not to be true, which makes him wise and smart, but not good. Because the claims he makes, whether you believe in God or not, are the essence of what godness is. Anyone who can make with the truth the claims that Jesus made about himself, historic and on the record, would have to be a God, if not the God, to make such claims. And then Canon Brian Green said they were vindicated. Because if any one of you, I remember him saying it to the audience, Stanford University profs and students, if any one of you, he said, were to make those claims, including the claim that your death would somehow set right the most fatal thing wrong with the world, and that 3 days later you would come out of the tomb, and if you did, then one ought to take another look at the claims, at the person who made those claims, and the claims. And then he said, tomorrow night, I will give you evidence of the resurrection. He never did. I came back the next night ready to sop it up. And he said, I've reconsidered the time I'm going to have here, and I've decided to go to the next topic, which flowed from, if Christ is what he said he was, does these things follow? Man, I gnashed my teeth. He never gave me a clue, except that if the resurrection were true, then I had to deal with this man and these claims.
This is the end of side one.